Hello and welcome back to Radio Rothbard. This is Ryan McMakin. I'm a senior editor at the Mises Institute, and with me today is Tho Bishop, my associate editor. And it's a couple of weeks after the election of 2020, and we're going to talk a little bit about strategy, political strategy. Now, Mises.org is not normally a strategy site. I don't run a lot of articles about what people should do to obtain political advantage over their adversaries and that sort of thing, and how they should vote or what they should do with the caucuses and so on. But the topic nevertheless does come up, and Rothbard wrote about it a fair amount. I wouldn't say a lot, but he was concerned that laissez-faire people, free market people, didn't think about it enough. And he makes the point that the Marxists were obsessed with strategy. 90% of their time was spent on strategy, and only 10% of the time was spent on philosophy. And he said that free market people were the reverse of that, and they should maybe spend more than 10% of their time on strategy. But Tho and I will talk a little bit about that today. How you doing, Tho?
I'm doing great. It's a fun topic.
Yes, we get a lot of comments on it from people in the comments sections, or they send emails to us, and they tend to attribute to me personally or to everyone who works at the Institute or to you what our views are on this topic. And there seems to be a lot of assumption that you and I are retreatists or quietists, or that we just believe in doing nothing. And that's not true at all. I don't know where these people get this idea. But then at the same time, also, anytime you do suggest that maybe people should vote no on that ballot issue that calls for a 50% tax increase, that you should just let that happen and retreat to Galt's Gulch or whatever place where you can just go hang out in some far-off place and I guess leave all your fellow humans in the city to just suffer. And so neither of these strategies I'm particularly fond of, and neither was Rothbard. And do you hear similar things from readers and others?
Yes. I mean, the good thing is that, you know, within the libertarian movement in general, your criticism of strategy and other fellows in the movement is pretty frequent. But yeah, you either get, if you try to do anything, you're labeled a sellout often, or if you don't try to engage the process, then, you know, what are you doing to actually proceed with liberty? Again, I think this is exactly why Rothbard's contributions are so important, so great. I mean, you know, not only was he a great economist and historian and political philosopher, but again, it's his work in the 90s that I think on political strategy that you know, especially in the last 4 years, you know, it's amazing how relevant I think it is to the current environment. And that's, you know, if you want Rothbard from his work from the 70s to become reality, I think you have to take seriously what he had to say in the 90s. And that's why I've enjoyed these last few episodes kind of diving into some of this stuff.
And to be sure, a lot of this stuff he wrote on strategy didn't actually appear at Mises.org. He wrote it for other publications and for what was the predecessor of LouRockwell.com back then, and for other places, because, of course, Mises.org is primarily a more scholarly site, more committed to policy and economics and looking at those sorts of things. And that sometimes is the criticism we get. But the reality is you can't do everything. There are good organizations out there that deal more with the political side of things. And there are organizations like ours that deal more with the academic, scholarly, public opinion side of things. And everyone seems to think everybody should do everything, but that's a very rare person, as I've noted. Rothbard was a rare person who was well-versed and excited about both of those things, but you need both sides of that. And that rather brings us to this distinction that Rothbard makes when talking about strategy, is there's two sides to it. There's what some people kind of snidely call educationism. And this is the idea, depending on how you define it, was that if you need to change the world, you need to change people's ideas, and you need to do this through educational institutions. Now, some people like Hayek have been criticized because they perhaps focus too much on the academic realm. So they didn't even really think it was necessary to directly engage, say, newspaper readers, writing op-eds, being what are called public intellectuals. Hayek perhaps thought, as many academics do, speaking from experience, having been in a PhD program, thinking that, well, it's enough to just influence the high, high end of ideas, and then those ideas will filter down automatically to the less intelligent people out there in the public. At least that's the thinking in a lot of academic programs. Rothbard wasn't satisfied with that. He, of course, regularly wrote op-eds and that sort of thing. Nevertheless, although some people have said that Rothbard did not like the concept of educationism, that's not true at all. He explicitly says that this is the only way that ideas get spread is, first of all, you have to have the people who are committed theorists, people who are serious scholars who actually know history and theory and philosophy and so on, that they can explain things. But then you need popularizers, right? You need people like Henry Hazlitt, who spread the ideas of Ludwig von Mises in places like Newsweek, which he did. And you need people who are out there spreading these ideas. Nowadays, we have lots of outlets of doing that through the internet and so on. And the idea is that it's not enough to just do it at the top end, but you have to do it through other avenues as well. And that's a form of educationism. And Rothbard said that is a thing that has to happen. It's just not enough in itself.
The people that I think are proudly call themselves Hayekian, you know, in today's world, I think they definitely kind of take pride in being anti-populist in their strategy regard. And what's interesting, though, about this is that, you know, what made Hayek Hayek, right, particularly in America, you know, was obviously the success of Road to Serfdom. But what really made Road to Serfdom the phenomenon, again, within the U.S. audience that it was actually not the book itself, but the condensed Reader's Digest version of it, right? And that itself was a way of taking these ideas and translating it down to normal people. It was, you know, average folks that were able to read this short little comic about the dangers of you know, how war planning ends up building a totalitarian state, that you know, elevated him as being one of the most important philosophers in the American right at that time. And then, of course, Mises himself, who, I mean, you know, man of old Vienna, an incredible scholar in his own right before he, you know, had to flee Europe. You know, he also recognized, I mean, you know, the institutions that made up the early parts of the libertarian movement, these were not institutions that were firmly grounded in higher education, right? I mean, you know, Hayek was, or Mises was teaching at NYU, but, you know, his salary had to come from outside benefactors. You know, he was completely mistreated by academia in, you know, FDR's America. But you had a lot of people, you had the manufacturing group at the time that was trying to identify and promote ideas that were pushing back on, you know, New Deal policies, that saw the importance of consolidating, you know, bringing down the ideas of Mises and Hayek to the masses. And I mean, that was really the origins of, you know, that libertarian aspect of the old right that you know, Rothbard found so inspiring. That, you know, so the, you know, even the great scholars that didn't quite perhaps share Rothbard's enjoyment of brawling and some of the inner political battles that you know, came throughout Rothbard's career, particularly in the 90s, you know, even Mises and Hayek, you know, their success, you know, their imprint on, you know, American life in large part came from an explicitly popular approach to educationalism, beyond simply trying to, you know, put a few choice scholars in a few important institutions.
Well, that's a good point, right? We should emphasize that people like Mises and Rothbard were very much engaged in public affairs, and not just in writing things for the public to read either. In his younger days, of course, Mises, as you note, was essentially working for a sort of chamber of commerce organization, and certainly had no problem with engaging policymakers. And then later Rothbard He did a lot of things that most people don't know about. For example, when I ran an article about a congressman from Nebraska, and we ran one of his speeches, and Howard Buffett is his name, and he was a free market guy from back in the 50s, and I just ran an article that talked about him because one of our writers sent in this article. And then I get an email from Lou saying, did you know that Murray used to write speeches for this guy? And so in his 20s and 30s, Murray was already writing speeches for free market members of Congress and things like that. Surely something he was just volunteering to do. And that's just an example there of the ways that he was trying to engage the public. He certainly wasn't talking about just retreating to a mountain hideout somewhere. Before we move on from the topic of educationism, though, and to Rothbard's Leninist strategy, as we'll call it, what are some of these key things that need to be done? What would you say are some of the most important aspects of the educational engagement that needs to be done? Obviously, as someone that works for the Mises Institute, I think it's important to do what we do, which is to make information available to the public, to make books available free online, to maintain the history of the movement and these ideas that prior to Mises.org were extremely difficult to get. I remember having to write a letter and send it into free market organizations, put a stamp on the envelope, all that sort of thing. And this was in the 90s, right before the internet became a thing. And it was just so slow, and it was just so hard to get the information. Now you have a whole library at your fingertips. And clearly, that does make a difference. Otherwise, people wouldn't know anything about this. And then in times like right now, you would have no way of knowing that there were other ideas out there to contradict what you were being told relentlessly on the media. And there would be simply no hope of really spreading these ideas at all. And this was a point Lou makes as well, is that when we look out there and we see that, say, 90% of the population supports greater socialism in the economy, which, well, maybe it's not as high as 90%, but it's up there. Recent polls have shown, right, 60, 70%. And Lou says, just imagine how it would be if we didn't have all of these free market organizations or all of these books from people like Mises and Rothbard. It would be 99% in favor of socialist tyranny, was the phrase that Lou uses. And of course, he's right. If there would be no dissent whatsoever and no serious ideological combat going on. And so clearly, that's a lot of what the Mises Institute is doing. But what can people who maybe don't have academic credentials and so on, what should they be doing on the educational side?
Taking these ideas and translating in a way that making them relevant to normal people. The beauty of it is that there's so many different ways of going about it. You know, it can be everything from applying it to very local issues that in your community where, you know, you can stand out because, you know, you're the only one that seems to have any idea on the major importance of, you know, some economic related issue here in your area. It can be in if you're in a certain community that has nothing to do with politics or economics or serious ideas, but you know, you can interject concept. It, particularly with I think the beauty of Austrian economics is there's so many. The entire a methodology and understanding of social phenomenon in general, right? Where, you know, we're not trying to, turn everything into a math equation. You know, there's a beautiful logic and harmony to so many of the core kind of Misesian concepts that, there's ways of applying it in different areas of making people think about things in ways that they're not taught in schools, that once you start unrolling that thread, it's very interesting where people can end up in. I mean, I know we have, we have one Mises U alum that is big in the cosplay community, and so she's able to use her following to kind of talk about, her views on the state and economics and markets and things like that. And so here is someone utilizing a position that is completely disconnected from this stuff, but able to then communicate these deeper ideas in a way that it introduces them to people that would otherwise never come in contact with them. And that the power of those ideas the way that they manifest themselves into tangible outcomes afterwards, once you kind of spark them in minds. I mean, that's really, I think, one of the interesting things that, I don't think the Institute gets nearly enough credit for some of the real life kind of inventions that came about simply because we made, books that, a lot of people didn't want to publish, freely available. I mean, Bitcoin was unquestionably, inspired by Austrian economics. And, we were the ones kind of keeping that torch alive, right? Wikipedia was directly influenced by Hayek's work on the use of knowledge in society, which Jimmy Wales, the founder, discovered because he was a student at the University of Auburn. And even, kind of in a political nature, you have a lot of state and local representatives that, discovered us, in the last 10 years and have been trying to figure out ways of putting in some relatively radical stuff within political discourse because they got really inspired. They had this sort of heroic sort of mindset because we were, presenting something that was so different from the mainstream. And that's something I think it's inspiring in a way that, you can dismiss it. Oh, we're just talking about ideas in a vacuum. What are we going to do with it? Well, the Institute doesn't have to come up with all the ideas, right? Mises doesn't have to come up with every single application of what he's writing about. Other people do that. There's a division of labor in any sort of ideological movement the way there is in the economy. And the more that we can simply get these core foundational concepts out there for other people to then apply, better off we are. And the internet obviously is a massive, the ability of short circuiting, what used to be the gatekeepers of knowledge, right? And if you didn't have, books on Austrian economics in your local library, or tied into, maybe the larger libertarian movement was kind of the larger mechanism for distribution. If you weren't tied into that, how are you ever going to discover this stuff? Because obviously you're not going to get it in the public education system. So, technology has allowed for allowing us to talk about these things and getting into people that in ways have never would have otherwise never been possible. And even today, the global growth where these ideas are completely new to people. I think we can kind of get jaded, a lot of people out there, I'm sure, we probably came into Austrian economics, libertarians, the Ron Paul movement, it's considering Ron Paul's, 2008, right? So we're now, 12 years since the big awakening. I think American libertarians can kind of get a little like, oh, we've heard all this sort of stuff before, but there's new frontiers out there even that are able to take this stuff and run with it in ways that shouldn't be dismissed. And so there are some very exciting things that can happen, when people with unique individual talents and networks apply the core knowledge in ways that have consequences in the real world.
Well, and of course, the left mastered these methods a long time ago, and it's part of the reason now why they dominate educational institutions, cultural institutions. You mentioned cosplayers, right? And some people might say, oh, well, I mean, what difference does that make? Well, of course, the left figured out long ago that's essential. You should absolutely be having artists come around to your point of view, writers, actors, Hollywood in general, which is clearly dominated by a certain ideological viewpoint. And that has a real effect. When you see a movie where all the heroes are of a certain type and all the villains are of another type, that starts to send the message home. And that has a real effect. And then, of course, you see that in pop culture. And then you go to your public school where all the teachers were educated at a university where they received a certain ideological line of thinking. And there's basically no escape as long as you stick to those institutions. You have to create parallel institutions that provide other points of view. And I just continue to be mystified by these people who fancy themselves great anti-establishment thinkers. They would never just do what the state tells them to do. And then they send their kids to 12 years of public school. And then Johnny comes home and says, hey, Dad, I'm a communist now. And then Dad doesn't understand how that happened. Like, I can explain to you how that happened, pops. You handed your kid over to the state for 12 years. Not a surprising outcome. But this just happens everywhere. It's not as if in places that are dominated by people who are members of the GOP don't send their kids to public school. They have they send their kids to public school in pretty much the same numbers as anywhere else. And all they do is have, they just have better funded public schools. But the teachers come from the same place and they teach pretty much the same stuff. So not a significant difference there, especially when these then send your kids to pretty much any American university, which it doesn't matter if it's public or not, because they're all essentially federally funded at this point. So the left figured that out so long ago, and I just continue to be surprised when people say, well, you just can't sit around and try to influence people's ideas. I'm like, really? Because that's what the left did to master the public debate on almost every topic. So it seems like it's a winning strategy if you don't give up on it after 5 minutes, like many conservatives seem to want to do. So clearly that's very important. I did an article on this called Three Reasons Why the Left Keeps Winning. And it has a lot to do with that, is because they took over these educational institutions, and stuck with it for decades. And if you don't address that, I did another article called Why GOP Loyalists and Candidates Keep Moving Left. And that's what happens when you have political action, but no ideological grounding. Then your political movement is just ideological adrift. And the public doesn't really believe in your message, so you have to constantly move toward where the public ideology is to get elected. If you don't do that, you just don't get elected. I think a lot of people out there imagine there's a lot more people who agree with them than actually do. So all my friends are hardcore free market people. So there must be, if we could just get a candidate out there who runs on a hardcore free market ticket, he's sure to win in a landslide. Well, I doubt it. Unless he's in a small particular congressional district that is packed with those sorts of people, he's not going to win a nationwide election and probably not many statewide elections as well. Why? Because you have a public now that spent 12 years in public school and another 4 years in university and then even more time in graduate school, and they watched all those Hollywood movies for 30 years. And so now they have a particular ideology that is very hostile to markets. So if you think the public is just brimming with secret libertarians, it's probably not true. And that's why you have to address the educational side of things first. But that's not the only thing. There's the political side of it. And this is what's called Rothbard's Leninist strategy. And Rothbard also thought that even if you're out there running a successful educational campaign, you have to ask yourself a lot of questions. And these are questions like, who should we target for our educational campaign? Should it be the elites? Should it be the general public? Or who within the general public? Small business owners, the middle classes, the lower classes? What are the institutions we should use? And all of these questions really need to be answered because resources are finite. And you have to come up with ideas of where to target your efforts. And that's not just self-evident. You have to think about it and really convince other people within the movement of where their resources should be devoted and spent. Now, Rothbard then, he came up with some examples here. Now, I would, just before I say anything else, I would note someone who's pretty successful at this was Ron Paul. And Ron was building on a very small minority that had very free market views. And he managed to do a lot with it. A lot with a small percentage of people who are in our current world where all of these institutions are dominated by ideas very hostile to Ron Paul and his message. In other times and places, there's been more of a public that was accepting of laissez-faire and those sorts of ideas. Rothbard pushes James Mill as the prototype for this in his writings. And what does he mean by that? Well, he talks about Mill as a very important person in Parliament. He couldn't serve in Parliament because of his associations with some government corporations and so on. But he was able to win over to his side a lot of members of Parliament, and he was able to command a lot of personal loyalty. He was even able to really issue orders on what should these ideological groups be doing in the political sphere, and really became quite successful at pushing through the agenda of what at the time was known as a group known as the Radicals in Britain. And this was related to the Liberals under Cobden as well, but a little bit different. They had a far more militant democratic view. But Mill was clearly very successful at this, and Rothbard holds him up, not as necessarily someone that you need to agree with in all of his ideological views or his even the minutiae of his methods, some of which were dishonest. But Mill was a master organizer, and he also recognized the importance of winning over just even a small minority in Parliament could be very successful in pushing certain ideas, certain bills, and really helping to move forward a ideology into the public and political realm.
When Rothbard was looking at, okay, well, what is the marketplace? You know, where is the audience that we should really be trying to direct our message? I mean, I know that from just Raimondo's biography on Rothbard and some of his other writings on strategy is that, you know, it really was, I think, that Libertarian Party race in 1988 that ended up having as much influence on, you know, some of his later works on strategy as, you know, so like the Pat Buchanan campaign in 1992, which was obviously very significant as well. Because what he started, you know, within the libertarian movement, and you see this still today. I mean, there was a few years ago, I think Nick Gillespie was debating, I think it was Dave Smith, on the question of postmodernism, and they were getting to some topics about, okay, what really is libertarianism? And Nick Gillespie kind of saw libertarianism as as the freedom to pursue alternative lifestyles, which again, you know, fine, you know, everything, peace, whatever. But I don't, is that, you know, do most people get up in terms of mobilizing politically in defense of alternative lifestyles? Is that really kind of their core motivating drive in how they engage with government? And I think for most people, it's really not true. And most people kind of, they want to be left alone. You know, they want to be free to grill, you know, right? Like that's, it's more Hank Hill than it is a Nick Gillespie. And Ron Paul kind of fit that, right? I mean, he was criticized. I mean, in that the 1988 primary, you know, I think it was the running against, it was Russell Means, I think was the, I think it was like a Native American activist, something like that. And you kind of had like the outside outcast sort of hippie types side with Means because he was kind of a more of a personally sort of radical guy. And then, like, you know, you had Ron Paul that, you know, married for so many years with, you know, wonderful, charming wife and living a very, you know, American dream sort of existence. And, you know, he was kind of, you know, I think Rothbard kind of described him as, you know, he was kind of square, right? You know, he was, you know, normal American. And, you know, what Rothbard realized is that, you know, if the libertarian message was really going to be powerful in a common political environment, we had to figure out a way of making our ideas as radical as they are. And yeah, I think that's something that libertarians often kind of get blinded to is that, you know, libertarian ideas seem so logical to us, right? They're so consistent and there's an elegance there. You know, you go to your average person on the side of the road, and you talk about abolishing all government schools, like they're going to look at you like a crazy person more often than not. You know, maybe if you're living in some cities in New Hampshire, maybe they might be more favorable to that. But, you know, average people, I think that's kind of out there. And so in order to appeal to those people, you know, chances are you're not going to get them to read an 800-page book. But if you kind of resonate with some of their anger and their frustration to the state as it exists today, you know, that, you know, people might not buy into every single part of a, you know, ANCAPistan dream, but if they believe that you're on the same side, that, you know, your enemies are their enemies and your allies are their allies, that's how you build coalitions in a meaningful way. And so that was what Ron Paul was very successful at doing, you know, within, you know, in Lake Jackson, Texas. It's why his message resonated so much in 2008 and 2012, you know, where you were able to build these very broad coalitions, you know, including, you know, very, you know, culturally left, you know, hardcore anti-war activists, along with homeschooling, you know, devout Christians in Iowa. Because, you know, Ron Paul's message was not, or, you know, was messaged in a way that, you know, it was, you know, it was proudly American. It was proud, you know, restore the republic. It was, you know, these people are ripping you off, you know, the Fed and Wall Street and the military industrial complex. And, you know, we need to restore kind of that American dream. That is a message that I think is a lot more powerful than trying to, again, the idea that, oh, well, the real core of libertarianism is defending, you know, the ability to have, you know, do heroin with your polyamorous relationship. I mean, the government should be necessarily stopping to stop that, but I don't think that as the goal is really the most politically powerful thing out there. And so Rothbard was always kind of looking at trying to build these coalitions and ways to make the ideas powerful, and that's something that, again, he gets a lot of criticism for it. You know, he went from the far left, you know, at the peak of Vietnam to kind of the Pat Buchanan, you know, more conservative coalitions in the 90s. But at the end of the day, the main goal was consistent. It was trying to identify the largest groups possible to spread, this radical idea of liberty. And there's a lot to learn, I think, from both the successes and failures in that throughout his career.
Well, Gillespie's view is pretty clearly ahistorical in terms of what historically has the free market, the laissez-faire liberal party supported in Europe, in the West, and so on, and it rarely had anything to do with alternative lifestyles. Certainly one of the most successful liberal movements in the West was the Anti-Corn Law League under Cobden. And what was their message? Their message was, rich people are ripping you off because they're insisting that there be a tariff on food. And so you, working man, you're paying more for your bread so that you can enrich land-owning nobles, basically. And so this was a very strong anti-rich guy movement, which supported the middle classes, the people who owned businesses and who were tired of having to pay high taxes, so that it could preserve this bucolic lifestyle that all of these rich landed gentry types thought was really the heart of England. They had a different vision for England. Their vision of England was that we all live on these farms and that we have to be independent in terms of food and so on. And that vision, however, required higher taxes on working people and business owners. And that was the real debate. That's what created the real success of the liberal movement in the 19th century in England. And then similarly in the United States, the liberal movement was so much focused on defeating central banking, on lowering taxes, on less interventionist foreign policy and so on. This idea that everybody's running around promoting some social idea is just really not what actually happened. And so I suppose you could push that as the core of libertarian thinking or whatever, but historically that's never been a successful libertarian movement. The successful ones were focused on economics and people being left alone and being separated and being allowed to function separate from the state. And that's really, if you look at libertarianism correctly, which is as just the modern version of 19th century classical liberalism or 18th century version of it as well, that's what it's about. And Ralph Rako used to make fun of that notion as well, talking about how a lot of these fringe libertarian types who think it's all about expressing yourself and so on. He notes that was never a real thing. Real liberals historically were concerned with things like banking and economics and trade and things that affected every single person in the country. And they were a lot more practical about it that way, a lot more down to earth. And so how do we bring about then? How do we bring about lower taxes? How do we fight the national security state? It seems to me that one important step that often gets neglected is just working at it at the local level. And I know that you've certainly been very active in this. And I'm amazed at how much people who claim to be really gung-ho on changing the system neglect the basic institutions of it. And this was something that James Mill never neglected, that Mill understood the importance of organization, even down at the very foundational, localized level within parliament or within the party, at the community level, with meetings of community activists and so on. He never shied away from that sort of stuff and had a lot of lieutenants who helped him with that. And he was very energetic on all of those issues. But so many people who claim to want radical change, they don't seem very interested at all in even knowing how the caucus system works, even knowing who their legislators are at the state level. These are sorts of people you could easily get a personal meeting with. It's unlike the Senate, where you have to be a millionaire to even get a call back from your senator. You could know these people personally, unless you're in a giant state like California or New York and so on. And there seems to be very little going on there with people who fancy themselves as these radical free market theorists.
Facebook and social media makes it so easy to be an activist just by kind of like posting things online. I certainly do a lot of that myself. So, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it's a way of you know, communicating with other people. The problem is that, like, within the libertarian movement in particular, like, I mean, you know, it's particularly in peak Ron Paul time, things like that, like, everyone started having all the same Facebook friends, right? You'd go to a libertarian movement, you know, convention, and, you know, everyone's exchanging social media information. Then you kind of, you work yourself into, like, this ghetto, this ideological ghetto, where, like, you're always having the same conversations with the same people. And it's great because everyone agrees with you. And so, you know, they pat you on the back, and, you know, you can think that you're very, very smart, and everyone that is a part, that you know, they don't understand this stuff. They're all sheeple. But it's not very productive in a way of trying to win over hearts and minds. It's not good on either a practical political perspective or even the educationalism standpoint. And you know, but it's easy, right? And it's like eating junk food at times, right? It can be comforting to kind of just talk within your own groups. But there is a lot of ways, if you're actually interested in winning over other people, there's a plenty of mechanisms within, you know, whether it's local politics or local community groups or things like that, where, you know, you have audiences where the ideas, because the ideas of, you know, small government, liberty, and no matter how radical you want to take it, right, there's practical value there, you know, explaining why taxes are ripping you off and, you know, don't provide all the services that, you know, politicians, you know, claim to has this idea of thinking like an economist, so that you can see the seen and the unseen. You know, there's value there, but it requires going out and talking to people that aren't necessarily within the clubhouse. And you know, it's particularly like in a state like Florida, there's a lot of community oversight in terms of educational curriculums. And a lot of that kind of comes back to some of the backlash against Common Core, which that itself was kind of a product of kind of the Tea Party era, where you had this very interesting coalition of ideas, you know, again, that's, you know, Road to Serfdom, you know, Hayek stuff. We have kind of this resurrection of the American thought because you had this backlash to Obama era things. And so you had all sorts of kind of interesting, you know, ideas, Tom Wood's books on nullification, right? You know, very popular this time, where you had average kind of normie Republican activists kind of looking for ways of fighting back against federal government, you know, recognizing there was more of a role there for federalism and state governments, right? So that was a useful political movement, even if it kind of petered out, especially at the congressional level. You know, a lot of sellouts there. But it was a way of getting these ideas out there and with normal people. In a way that has, you know, at least allowed for the possibility of having significant change. And so again, like a state like Florida, like I can go out there and try to get, you know, economics in one lesson, you know, within the school system, and which again, you know, that itself isn't, you know, quite the same thing as privatizing all the schools and, you know, getting government completely out of the way. But anytime that you can bring real substance to people that would otherwise not be engaged with it. You know, I think there's value in that. And so, and of course, every area is different. Every, states have different ways of doing it. Counties have different levels of access. But, you know, if you're willing to, if you care enough about the ideas to try to figure out, you know, how you can make an impact within your local community, rather than simply thinking about the libertarian movement as a online, you know, sphere, you think about, you know, your actual neighbors. You know, that's something I think is a lot more productive than, you know, simply talking about this stuff with the same, you know, 100 people in a social media group.
Well, and you make a good point there also, in that there is action that could be taken at the local level far above and beyond mere politics. And you don't necessarily need to be involved in political institutions, party institutions, that sort of thing, where you could just become a person in your community who's maybe well-regarded within the community and maybe has influence that way. This, of course, was a priority among the early liberals in the 18th, 19th century. You should probably be a respectable person in your community and actually contribute something to society, and then people might actually care what your opinions are. This, of course, is much more useful than just being a completely anonymous person yelling things into the void on the internet. That is of rather limited value, especially since, as you note, people are mostly just listening to people they already agree with anyway. You're not really sending messages to people who are, A, disagreeing with you, and B, if they disagree with you, open to changing their mind. That's much, much harder to do over the internet than perhaps within your own community. And we should probably wrap up at this point. I don't want to leave without noting that even if you're not interested in any sort of political action, there is no shame in simply being a person who raises his family or her family and engages in a respectable life of contributing to your family and your community and the economy. I don't want to imply that any of those people aren't contributing anything. It's just this episode happens to be about acting within the ideological and political realm, but I don't want to make it seem that people who aren't doing a lot of that aren't doing anything. So I just want to be clear about that. But thank you very much for joining me and Tho on this episode of Radio Rothbard, and we'll be back next time with more. Until then, have a wonderful week.